If you have your homeworks, I think we'll just put them right here.
The health expenditures as the X or the Y. I need it both ways just in case.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started if we can this morning. What I'd like to do is to first quickly review the topics that we covered in lecture number one, and then we're going to move on to continue our consideration of the leading causes of mortality in developed and developing countries. And today we're going to focus on causes of death for children under the age of five. So last time we took a quick look at course organization. All of the information about the course is on the website. If you missed the username and the password for the textbook, the username is BioE301, all lowercase, and the password is technology, all lowercase. I did update chapter 4 late last night, I think. And chapter 4 is the chapter that goes over all of the causes of mortality by age group. I will always, as I update things on the website, on the students page, I'll put a note to let you know what's been updated. Okay? We talked about the goals of the course, the four questions that we'll answer. Right now we're in Unit 1 looking at what are the major health problems worldwide. And we talked a little bit about technology assessment. We'll come back to that just for a minute today. What is health? The role of the WHO. And we'll look a little bit more at some health data today, and you took a look at that as part of homework number one. So in technology assessment, we looked at our example of the development of the technology high-dose chemotherapy followed by stem cell rescue. We looked at that example, I think, as a very good example of what can happen in the real world when technology assessment isn't used in an appropriate way. And there are many different ways of doing technology assessment, but one process that I like is a process that was first described by a guy named Ben Littenberg, who's on the faculty at Emory. And the steps in his process are first to look at the biological plausibility. From a biological point of view, does the new technology make sense? Does the science support the idea of the technology? Second step is looking at technical feasibility. Do we have the ability to safely and reliably deliver this technology to patients? And the answer to that question will differ depending on what setting you're in. If you're at a tertiary care center like MD Anderson Cancer Center, it will be very different than if you're in a community hospital in a small rural community or if you're in a developing country. Next step is to look at clinical trials. And the most important type of a clinical trial is a randomized clinical trial, where you're going to compare the effect of an intervention in your experimental group to an appropriate control group, and you're going to randomly divide patients between those groups. We saw with our example of high-dose chemo to treat breast cancer that many times what patients believe about the effectiveness of a technology will affect whether or not they're willing to participate in a clinical trial. If they believe that this new technology is very, very effective and it may be their only hope for survival, they will be much less willing to let the roll of the dice depend what treatment they receive. And then long-term patient outcomes are very, very important. Are the patients in the long run better off for having used the technology? We saw with high-dose chemo that when they were receiving that treatment, clearly their quality of life was much lower than patients who are receiving the standard therapy. if there had been a dramatic survival benefit to that new technology, it might have been worth those patients in the long run to have lower quality of life for a short period of time. And then we need to look at societal outcomes. That technology was more expensive than standard therapy, but again, if there had been a substantial survival benefit, it might have been something that as a society we say we're willing to make that investment. One of the things that we will look at as we move to unit number 2, where we look at who pays to solve healthcare problems, is as a society, how much are we willing to spend to gain 1 year of life? Okay, we have to make a decision about what we're willing to pay for and how we trade off. You know, are we going to invest in healthcare or are we going to invest in education? And so we'll look at sort of where we've drawn the line for what technologies we're willing to pay for and what technologies we're not willing to pay for. So the steps of technology assessment, I think they're very logical. How are they actually used in practice? There are a number of groups that carry out technology assessments, and they try and make recommendations then about what should the appropriate care be for a patient who has a given diagnosis. And the outcomes of these technology assessments are usually referred to as consensus guidelines. And consensus guidelines are guidelines that a group of people have agreed represent the appropriate diagnostic or therapeutic treatment for a given disease. So their policy decisions about the use of technology, they're going to consider data and make a group judgment. One of the most important groups that puts together consensus guidelines is something called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They publish a book about every 4 or 5 years. I meant to bring it. I'll bring it next time. It's called The Guide to Clinical Preventive Services. And basically, you can look up any disease, and you will find the consensus guidelines for preventing that disease. What is known about effective technologies? What's the best evidence that we have? And what are the recommendations based on that evidence? And so I took an excerpt from the latest Guide to Clinical Preventive Services regarding HIV screening. Should we screen the entire population of the United States for HIV infection? Would that be a cost-effective and intelligent thing to do? The consensus guidelines are that no, it would not be a cost-effective thing to do. Instead, they recommend periodic screening for people who are at increased risk of infection. And this can be because of behavioral or lifestyle factors or because they live in a region of the country where the prevalence rates for HIV infection are high. It's also recommended for pregnant women who are at risk for infection and for infants who are born to high-risk women where the status of the mother is unknown. All patients, however, should be counseled about effective means to avoid HIV infection. And in this book, what they do is they go through all of the evidence and they characterize the strength of that evidence. There are many groups who put together these types of consensus guidelines. How frequently do you think when you go to the doctor, your therapy is based on these consensus guidelines? Most of the time? Rarely? What do you think? The Institute of Medicine did a review where they looked at how frequently patient care followed consensus guidelines. So they looked at how well our health systems use data to make these decisions. They wrote two reports, and a third one is being written right now, where they looked at healthcare quality in the United States. And what they found is that just over half of patients in the United States receive care that is consistent with the best available scientific evidence that we have. In fact, 18,000 Americans die every year from heart attacks because they didn't get preventive medicine, even though they should have. Okay? More Americans are killed every year as a result of medical error than by breast cancer, than by AIDS, and motor vehicle accidents. So medical errors and the failure to practice medicine according to consensus guidelines is actually a large cause of mortality in our country. So even when we do go through the technology assessment procedure in a proper way, we don't always follow those guidelines. Question? It could be a provider error. It could be a malfunction of a medical device. They looked at a broad range of types of medical error and lumped them all together. And the report actually goes through and takes a look at the different types of errors and how they could be prevented. There's a little bit more about that in Chapter 4. Okay. Also looked at the delay between when a new technology is discovered and when it's available to you as a patient. And I was pretty amazed by the length of this delay. It's 17 years between the discovery of a new technology and its widespread use. So a number of people are interested now in how can we reduce that time in a way that is still safe for patients. So this IOM report is a very, very interesting report. And the recommendations of the Institute of Medicine are to really try and change the nature of health systems so that the entire system works to prevent errors from occurring and to ensure that care is practiced according to consensus guidelines. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is to move into the material for lecture two, where we're going to take a little bit more of a look at health data and uses, and then we're going to take a look for children under the age of five, what are the leading causes of mortality in developed and developing countries. There's a very nice report on the WHO website called A Tale of Two Girls, and I'm not going to go through the entire thing. I would encourage you to do that. It takes maybe 10 minutes to go through this. But what it does is it contrasts the lifetime of two girls, one who would be born in Japan and one who would be born in Sierra Leone. And the life expectancy in those two countries differs by more than a factor of two. So in Japan, the average life expectancy for women right now is over 85 years. In Sierra Leone, it's 36 years. And in this presentation, they take a look at some of the reasons for those huge differences in life expectancy. So it's really an interesting little presentation. The URL for it is given right at the beginning of Chapter 4 in your text. Okay, so you're going to take a look in homework number 2 at calculating incidence rates, calculating prevalence rates, calculating mortality rates, and infant mortality rates. I don't think we have you calculating relative risk. And another quantity that we're going to refer to frequently, but is really too complicated for us to calculate, is something called the DALY. The DALY stands for the Disability Adjusted Life Year, and it's a measure of how many disability-free life years a person loses to disease on average. So for example, if a person has a stroke, on average they will lose 6 years of disability-free life. Okay? If they have a car accident, on average, a fatal car accident, on average they'll lose 9 disability-free years of life. People who commit suicide, on average, lose 17 years of disability-free life. Lower respiratory infections, on average, you lose 1 disability-adjusted life year. For HIV, on average, 28. And a DALY, the nice thing about DALYs is that they combine the effects of mortality and the effects of morbidity. So it combines how severe is the disease while you're still living and how many years of life do you lose as a result of disease. I'm going to go through some maps of different types of health data. This map shows life expectancy at birth for the year 2000. And the legend here, this goes from 33 to 52 in the dark green, 75 to 81 in the yellow. I think what you'll see as we go through these maps, you'll see patterns where they look very similar. Here we're looking at infant mortality rate. And they go from 3 to 8 per 1,000 births, here from 80 to 220 per 1,000 live births. Here we're looking at gross national income per capita at purchasing power parity. I'm not going to define PPP during class. There is a definition of it in chapter 3, I believe. If we look here, this is in US dollars at PPP. It goes from $480 to $1,500 in green to between $10,000 and $48,000 in yellow. And you can see that there are strong correlations between the health data and the economic data. Here we're looking at access to safe water. This is the fraction of the population that has access to safe water, 95 to 100% in yellow, 13 to 57% in green. And we'll see that for children under the age of 5 who live in developing countries, diarrheal diseases are a leading cause of death, and lack of access to safe water is frequently a cause of diarrheal disease. This looks at the percentage of the population that have access to the internet. Here we see 40 to 80% in pink, and the dark red varies from 0 to 1.9%. So the availability of infrastructure, the economic data, and health data are all highly correlated. So again, I'm going to skip through the definitions of this. You can read about it in chapter 3. You looked at per capita health spending in homework number 1 and how that correlated to a number of different types of health data. And we'll take a look at a graph of that in a minute. Another way to characterize some of these factors that are going to affect the health of a population is by something called the Human Development Index. And that's going to roll together achievements in health, like life expectancy, achievements in education, and income. And so this is a global map of the Human Development Index. Here, green indicates countries that have a high level of development. Yellow and orange indicates countries that have a medium level of development. And red indicates countries that have a low level of development. So this is going to roll together health, education, and income. So you were asked to plot things like life expectancy at birth in years versus health expenditures per capita. And I think you did this for 12 or so countries. I put 40 countries on this graph. Okay. You can see here we are in the United States with health expenditures per capita of about $4,500. And I've grouped things together in 4 different colors, the U.S. in blue, other countries here in red, group of countries here in purple, group of countries here in pink. Okay, let's consider the difference between the red and the purple. What are the main differences between countries that fall in this group and countries that fall in this group? How much they're spending, and also broadly, would they fall into the category of a high development country or a low or a medium development country on that HDI, okay? And so here, these are all what we would consider to be developed countries, and here we'd have many developing countries. What's the difference between the purple and the pink? Geographic location. Many of these are African countries. Many of these countries have also recently experienced major conflict. OK. Okay, and HIV and AIDS is a very big problem in many of these countries. So broadly speaking, differences between these groups of countries, war and AIDS play a big role in the differences there. Okay, what about the differences between the red and the blue? Do we in the U.S. have the highest life expectancy? No. We certainly spend the most money on healthcare, however. Okay. So one of the things that we'll look at when we go into Unit 2, when we look at who pays to solve problems in healthcare, is why is this number so big? And why don't we seem to get more of a benefit for that additional spending? Okay. You looked at a number of other types of health data, but they, broadly speaking, correlate in the same way to health expenditures. So we've talked about developed countries, we've talked about developing countries, and there really is not a universal definition for the difference between the two. Usually they're categorized by a per capita income. A low-income developing country is one where the average per capita income is less than $400 a year. A middle-income developing country would be somewhere between $400 and $4,000 per year in per capita income. With regard to the World Trade Organization, countries decide for themselves, are they considered a developed or a developing country? And it brings them certain rights. The United Nations has developed a category called the least developed country. And this was first done in 1971. Countries have to apply to be considered a least developed country. In general, they're characterized by a per capita income of less than $900, low levels of human capital development and education. Their economy has to be vulnerable. Originally, there were 25 least developed countries, and as of today, nearly 10% of the world's population lives in one of the world's 49 least developed countries. Population growth in these countries is expected to triple by 2050. And if we look at, here's where most of the least developed countries are. So many of them are located in Africa. There's a tiny little island called Kiribati. There's a wonderful book called The Sex Lives of Cannibals about a graduate student whose wife was an aid worker, and they went to live on the island of Kiribati, and he writes about what it was like to go from living in Washington, D.C. to living on this atoll along the equator, and how different his life was when he went there and what the transition was like for him when he came back to the United States. One of the things that we'll be doing for our homework assignments later on during the semester is you'll be choosing a book from a list of books to read that are in some way relevant to world health, and The Sex Lives of Cannibals is one of the books that's on that list. It's a really funny book. So if we look at health and other data in the least developed countries, average per capita income in the LDCs is just over $200. If we compare that to all other developed countries, you can see it's substantially less, almost two orders of magnitude less. Average life expectancy in the LDCs is just over 50. In Botswana, life expectancy is projected to be only 27 by 2010. In industrialized nations, compares to an average life expectancy of 78 years. We'll see as we look at infant mortality rates, they're very, very high in the LDCs. 1 in 10 children will die before their first birthday in LDCs. 40% of all children under the age of 5 are underweight or are suffering from stunted growth due to malnutrition. Half the population in these countries is illiterate, so there are a number of challenges that these countries face. Here we compare the mortality rate for children under 5. In high-income countries, it's 6 per 1,000. In the LDCs, it's 151 per 1,000 live births. Again, looking at health expenditures in the LDCs, they spend an average of $16 per person per year on health expenditures compared to $1,800 a person in high-income countries. If we look at measles, an example of a preventable disease with vaccination, children born in LDCs are more than 1,000 times more likely to die from measles than children born in industrialized countries, predominantly because of differences in the rates of vaccination. Okay, what I want to do now is move on to look at the specific causes of death for children under the age of 5. Before we get there, this is a very broad comparison of developing countries and developed countries. And what's presented in this graph is the causes of death grouped into three different groups. Group 3 is injury. Okay? Group 1 is basically infectious diseases, maternal and perinatal conditions, and nutritional deficiencies. And group 2 is more the chronic disease group, things like heart disease, cancer, and mental disorders. So if we look at developed countries, here are injuries, here are infectious diseases, and here is cancer, heart disease, all the non-communicable diseases. Contrast that to the role that infectious disease plays in developing countries. So the health challenges are really very, very different in these two settings. And we will see this at its most extreme for children under the age of 5. What this graph does is it looks at the mortality rate in developed countries compared to the mortality rate in developing countries. We're taking the ratio of the mortality rate in the developing countries, dividing that by the mortality rate in developed countries. And we're doing that by age. Here's one. So you can see that for every age, you're more likely to die if you're living in a developing country. But that increase is greatest for children under the age of 5, and it comes down and then stays constant at about a factor of 1.5 throughout adulthood. So really, for children, the health problems that they face are particularly problematic in developing countries, and we'll see that today. So if we look at child mortality, first just some statistics about the number of children that die every year in the world. 10 million children under the age of 5 die every year in the world. 98% of these are in developing countries. If we compare that to the number of children who are born each year in the United States and Canada, the number of children that die in developing countries is more than 2 times the number of children that are born every year in the United States and Canada. Two-thirds of these could be prevented with available technology. We have it today. It doesn't need to be invented or perfected. And these are technologies that are feasible to implement in low-income countries. Now, if we look at how old these children are when they die, what we find is that 40% of these deaths occur in the first month of life. And in fact, 25% of these deaths occur in the first week of life. Why do you think it is that the neonates and during the perinatal period, most of these deaths occur? In the back? Yep.
Since infectious disease is such a problem, neonates, and I would imagine perinates too, don't have a developed immune system yet.
I think that plays a role, but as we'll see, in many cultures, there's a tradition to keep the mother and the baby isolated for the first period of life so that they aren't exposed to infectious organisms in the community, and that tends to have a little bit of a protective effect, so I don't think that can explain all of it, but I think it probably explains part of it. Yep? Right, we're going to see a lot of births at home, a lot of births that aren't attended by a midwife or a physician, so that's going to play a role. And certainly lack of access to health care during pregnancy is going to play a role. What about immunization campaigns that were carried out in developing countries in the 1970s and the 1980s? Those prevent disease like measles, pertussis, preventable infectious diseases that killed a lot of children after they made it past this period. And so, as a society, we have managed to put in place campaigns to immunize children, and that has brought down mortality rates for children who are past this period of life. So that's a problem that in some ways is easier to solve than looking at reducing the causes of death during the perinatal and the neonatal period. And so many people are concerned that if we want to continue to bring down child mortality rates, the part of the problem that was easier to solve has been solved, and that we really do need new approaches to bring down neonatal and perinatal mortality rates. Okay, so what I want to do now is I want to turn to what are the causes of mortality for children under the age of 5 in developing countries and developed countries. So perinatal conditions, these are conditions that occur between the 22nd week of pregnancy and the first 7 days after birth. That's the definition of the perinatal period. There are, every year in the world, it's estimated that there are about 3.3 million babies who are stillborn. Those numbers are not included in our count of 10 million, and probably it's underreported because the rates where incidence of stillborn children are the highest are places in the world where the vital registration rates are also the lowest. We're going to look predominantly at things that happen during childbirth and in the week after that contribute to these perinatal deaths. The number two cause of death in this age group is lower respiratory infections, predominantly pneumonia. As we'll see, during the first week of life, pneumonias predominantly occur as a result of exposure to infectious organisms in the maternal genital tract. After that, then it's more exposure in the community. Diarrheal diseases, third leading cause of death in this age group in developing countries, and then malaria. I'm going to skip through malaria today. We'll talk a little bit more about malaria next time. In the developed world, perinatal conditions, congenital anomalies, lower respiratory infections, and unintentional injuries are the four leading causes of death here. So let's take a look at perinatal conditions. So we said about 25% of deaths in this age group occur during the perinatal period. 2.5 million children every year die in that first week of life. And in fact, more than 500,000 women die from complications associated with childbirth. Most of the deaths during this period are a result of women not having access to health care during their pregnancy and during delivery. And they include low birth weight babies, birth asphyxia, where the umbilical cord can wrap around the child's neck during delivery, birth trauma, where there's a failure of the labor to progress and the child is many times severely injured during the birth process, and then infections that are acquired during childbirth as a result of exposure to organisms in the maternal genital tract. So if we look at birth asphyxia, that's defined as the baby doesn't breathe at birth, and generally it's a result of the umbilical cord being wrapped around the baby's neck. Birth trauma, the baby has to pass through the bony structures of the pelvis, and so the baby's head will actually mold to the pelvis in order to move through and descend during childbirth and delivery. And there are extreme mechanical forces that can prevent descent through the birth canal. It can result in intracranial hemorrhage, and there can be lifelong complications as a result of that. You can have trauma to internal organs and injury to spinal cord and other nerves as a result as well. If we take a look at the correlation between the number of births where there's no skilled attendant, no midwife, no physician attending the birth, the maternal mortality ratio, and the neonatal mortality ratio, you see that in Europe, where there are very few births that are not attended, both the maternal mortality rate and the infant mortality rate are low. But as that fraction of births where there's no attendant present goes up, we see that both the maternal mortality rate increases and the neonatal mortality rate increases. So having somebody there who's medically trained during labor and delivery makes a big difference in reducing both the maternal and the neonatal mortality rate. I have a good friend who is a gynecologic oncologist, and she and I have worked together for many, many years. And once I asked her, I said, why did you decide not to go into obstetrics? Because it just seems to me that there's something so wonderful about delivering babies, and it would be such a fulfilling occupation. And she said, the scary thing about obstetrics is that it is so unpredictable. Things are going along fine, you think the outcome's going to be good, and all of a sudden something goes wrong, and it's an emergency, and you have to react appropriately, or there are big consequences. And that goes along with the lack of good tools to predict who is going to need this emergency care during labor and delivery. We don't have a way of screening pregnant women to tell which ones are going to have just a perfectly uncomplicated delivery and which moms will have a complicated delivery. And as a result, everybody needs to have an attendant present during labor and delivery. There just are not any good screening tests to indicate who is going to need that emergency care. Infections can be acquired during exposure to organisms that are present in the maternal genital tract. Also, when the umbilical cord is cut, if a sterile instrument is not used to cut the umbilical cord, the neonate can acquire an infection. So we talked about the fact that in many cultures, you don't celebrate a child's birth until the first few weeks of life has passed. A good thing about that is the mom and the baby are isolated from infectious organisms in the community. A bad consequence of that, though, is that sometimes people will fail to seek medical care when it's needed. There are some simple technologies that can address these problems. We're going to look at an organization called PATH that is based in Seattle. And the mission of PATH is to develop new technologies that are appropriate for low-income settings to address global health inequalities. And so one of the things that PATH has developed is a delivery kit. And one of the things that the delivery kit includes is a sterile razor blade to cut the umbilical cord to reduce the number of umbilical cord infections. And in places where this has been used, there have actually been very dramatic reductions in perinatal mortality. The World Health Organization has developed a tool that's called a partograph. And a partograph basically is just a graph that allows you to plot the progress of labor. So in labor, the cervix dilates and the baby's head is going to descend. And so what they're going to do over time is they're going to plot the dilation of the cervix and the descent of the head, and they're going to look at the fetal heart rate. And so this is a tool that allows you to look at this and determine when does a woman need to be transferred to a hospital for emergency care. So it won't allow you to predict before she goes into labor, will she need emergency care. But once she goes into labor, if you have a midwife and she or he is using this tool, then they can quickly identify when labor is failing to progress and when a higher level of care is needed. And in your textbook, there's a nice example of the country Sri Lanka, which has done a great job of reducing infant mortality rate. And it talks about how they adopted this tool very early and how the fraction of births that are attended is very, very high in that country. Okay. Let me move on now to lower respiratory infections, mostly pneumonias. 1 million children die every year as a result of pneumonia. This is a disease that's an infection of the lungs. It can be caused both by a bacteria and by viruses. Newborns tend to acquire this infection from exposure during childbirth. Older children acquire it from the community. And the problem with pneumonia, of course, is it interferes with the ability to oxygenate the blood. And this image shows that very nicely. If we look at the airway, here's a bronchiole coming in, and it's going to split as it comes down into your lungs into tiny little sacs that are called alveoli. So here's an alveoli, and these are lined by the epithelial cells of the lung. So blood, deoxygenated blood, is going to come in here from the pulmonary artery, branch into this capillary network that rings the surface of these sacs that we're going to breathe air into. This blood will pick up oxygen from the air. It will travel now out into the pulmonary vein, where it's going to get pumped to the tissues of the rest of the body. In a pneumonia, what happens is you have infection, and so the alveoli can become consolidated with inflammatory response as you try and fight that infection. And so the fluid and the pus that are present in the alveoli will interfere with the ability to oxygenate blood. The symptoms of pneumonia: fever, cough, chest pain, and breathlessness. It can be fatal, particularly for children. In fact, until 1936, pneumonia was the leading cause of death in the United States. What happened after 1936? Antibiotics that could cure pneumonia were discovered. So bacterial infection causes about half of all pneumonias. These are the most common bacterial causes of pneumonia. And bacterial pneumonia can be treated with antibiotics. We'll come back to pertussis. Pertussis is a particularly serious disease for neonates, and we'll look at the pertussis vaccine and what happens when there are outbreaks of pertussis. Viral infection causes about half of all cases of pneumonia. The respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, is the most common viral cause of pneumonia. You may have heard about SARS. SARS is an emerging cause of pneumonia. Viral pneumonias will usually resolve on their own. In serious cases, you can give patients oxygen. They can breathe air that has an increased amount of oxygen. You can also give them antiviral drugs to help fight the viral infection. So the diagnosis of pneumonia is made on a chest x-ray. You can see consolidation within the lungs on the chest x-ray. Whether or not a pneumonia is viral or bacterial is generally determined by looking at a culture, either from the sputum, stuff that you cough up, or by sticking a needle into the lungs in between the ribs and pulling out a small amount of fluid from the lungs. Now, in developing countries, typically the technology to diagnose whether you have a viral or a bacterial pneumonia present isn't available. So the World Health Organization recommends that all pneumonias are treated with antibiotics in children. Okay? Now, that does reduce mortality. It's been clearly shown that if you just treat everybody, even though about half of the cases are viral, you will reduce mortality. The danger in that strategy, as we will see next time when we look at resistance in bacterial organisms, is that the overuse of antibiotics will produce more resistant pneumonias that are difficult to treat with antibiotics that we have available. So there's a big need for better diagnostic tests to discriminate between viral and bacterial pneumonias. There's a new test that's used in developed countries to look at diagnosing the presence of viral pneumonia. And this test is called the direct fluorescence assay. What you do in the direct fluorescence assay is you collect nasal secretions, and then you're going to spin down the cells that are present in the nasal secretions, and you're going to smear them onto a slide. Then you're going to fix those cells, and you'll immerse them in alcohol to fix them, so kill the cells. And then we're going to apply a solution to our cells, and that solution will contain antibodies, and those antibodies will bind to the viruses that cause pneumonia. And typically when you do a direct fluorescence assay, they include antibodies against all of the major causes of viral pneumonia, so you don't necessarily discriminate between which viral cause it is, you just establish that there's a viral infection present. Those antibodies are coupled to a fluorescent dye, so that then if we look at the cells under the fluorescence microscope, we see the green fluorescence associated with cells that are infected with the virus. And so this is a pretty quick point of care technology that allows you to identify whether or not you've got a viral pneumonia present. Okay, any questions about perinatal mortality or pneumonia before we move on? Okay. Well, I want to move on now to diarrheal disease. Diarrheal disease is a gastrointestinal disorder. It's characterized by frequent watery stools. It's also caused either by viral or bacterial infection. This time, the infection is present in the gastrointestinal tract. Bacterial causes include E. coli and cholera. Viral causes include the rotavirus. This is less common in neonates, more common in older children. And here, the isolation and breastfeeding both contribute to the reduction in incidence of diarrhea for very, very young children. Frequently, whenever you have unsafe drinking water, the incidence of diarrheal disease will be very, very high. The problem with diarrheal disease is that it can rapidly lead to dehydration, and that dehydration can be fatal. The way that the dehydration is fatal is you don't have enough fluid to maintain adequate blood pressure. So how do you lose so much water that you die? You only have to lose 10% of your blood volume. How does this happen? So in ordinary digestion, you eat, your food is mixed with water in the stomach. 98% of that water is going to be reabsorbed as this mixture passes through the colon. What happens in diarrhea is that the infection that takes place interferes with the reabsorption of water. And if you lose 10% of your bodily fluids, again, that's enough to be fatal. Oral rehydration therapy is a treatment for diarrhea that has saved millions and millions of lives in developing countries. And I think this is a great example of a very simple technology that can address a significant health problem. Oral rehydration is simply water, salt, and sugar. You mix it up, and the person who has diarrhea drinks it. It doesn't eliminate the diarrhea. The patient still continues to have diarrhea. What it does is it allows the colon to reabsorb fluid so that the fluid loss isn't so significant that you lead to dehydration. So how can such a simple technology work? If you just drink water, it doesn't work. If you just drink salt water, it doesn't work. You have to have the water, the salt, and the sugar for this to work. So oral rehydration therapy, if we look at the success of it, it reduced the mortality due to diarrhea from about 4.6 million deaths per year to only 1.8 million deaths per year in 2000. It was developed in the 1960s, adopted by the WHO in the early 70s, and the prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, in 1978 called oral rehydration therapy the most significant medical advance of the century. So how does it work? Well, if we look at the cells that line the colon, there are epithelial cells that line the surface of the colon. And their job is to help this fluid reabsorption happen. And the way that they do that is they actively pump out osmotically active things that are present in this mixture that's passing through the colon. And so water is going to follow because we want to equalize the osmotic pressure gradient on the two sides between the lumen and between the colon tissue underneath. And so these cells actively pump out sodium, and they absorb also osmotically active products of digestion. Predominantly, they work, though, in the colon by pumping out sodium, water follows because of osmotic pressure gradients. Well, what happens when you have a bacterial infection is the bacteria are going to make toxins, and the toxins interfere with the sodium reabsorption. So they also cause the cells, instead of pumping sodium out, they cause the cells to secrete chloride. And so now water's going the wrong way. You're going to have watery diarrhea as a result. So how does oral rehydration therapy work? Well, if you just give patients more water to drink, you're still pumping chloride out, you're not absorbing sodium, you're just going to produce more diarrhea. If you give them salt water, the bacteria are interfering with the ability to absorb that sodium, so you still just get more diarrhea. In the 1950s, however, scientists discovered that there was additional mechanism that these epithelial cells had to pump sodium out. And as long as there was glucose present, this pumping mechanism still worked even in the presence of the bacterial toxins. And that's why glucose in the oral rehydration therapy is so critical. So they theorized that if instead of just giving water or salt water, we put glucose in the water, that would enable this other mechanism of pumping sodium out to work. We can pump enough sodium out so that some water will follow and we won't dehydrate. And in fact, it works. Here's a package of oral rehydration salts. And in 1975, the WHO and UNICEF agreed on a uniform formulation of the oral rehydration therapy. A packet of this costs about 10 cents. In the United States, it's very interesting to look at the use of oral rehydration therapy. I had a friend whose son had a rotavirus infection. He had terrible, terrible diarrhea, got very, very dehydrated, took him into the pediatrician. Pediatrician gave him an IV and said, if your child was in a developing country, he'd be dead. Well, I think if her child had been in a developing country, he would have gotten oral rehydration therapy. He wouldn't have gotten an IV. And in fact, even though the consensus guidelines for care say that for children in the United States who are suffering mild or moderate dehydration, they should receive oral rehydration therapy like Pedialyte, which you can go buy at your grocery store, there have been surveys done of pediatric emergency room directors. Even though the right answer is giving oral rehydration therapy, in these surveys, only 6% of pediatricians say that's what they would give. Instead, they prefer to give IVs. And there are some historical reasons that happened, but I think it's a great example of how we don't always in our country make the best use of our healthcare resources. Vaccines to prevent diarrhea. You may have heard about the rotavirus vaccine. There was a vaccine to prevent rotavirus. Rotavirus is a terrible cause of diarrhea. It causes 30% of deaths due to diarrhea. It's found in every country. In fact, as you improve your sanitation system and your water system, the incidence of rotavirus does not go down. It's highly contagious. And almost every child will have one infection with rotavirus before they are 3 years old. And this is my son, who in 1998 had a very serious rotavirus infection. And I couldn't believe the quantity of diarrhea that this child produced as a result of this infection. I mean, it was just frightening to see all of this volume of fluid coming out of your child. So there was a lot of excitement about the rotavirus vaccine. The RotaShield vaccine was found to be 80 to 100% effective in some relatively large clinical trials. And it was FDA approved in 1998, just a month after Zachary had his little episode of rotavirus. So people began to use the RotaShield vaccine. And what happened is that there were a small number of serious complications that resulted. About 1 in 12,000 children actually died due to bowel obstruction. And so the company that manufactured the vaccine withdrew it from the market. And so when we look at our unit on developing vaccines, we'll consider why we have these post-licensure surveillance requirements. Now, there was a lot of debate at that time about whether this was a smart decision, because it was estimated that in developing countries, the rotavirus vaccine could save 500,000 lives a year, and at this complication rate, it would cause between 2,000 and 3,000 deaths per year. So there was a lot of debate about, if we're going to save 500,000 children a year, is it ethical to give a vaccine that we know will produce 2,000 to 3,000 fatal complications per year? Now, since that time, actually, there have been two additional rotavirus vaccines that have just gone through very large clinical trials that don't have the same complication rate, and it looks like they're about to be licensed by the FDA for use in the United States. The concern in developing countries is that these vaccines are very expensive. A dose of the vaccine is about $100. As we saw, the per capita health expenditures in least developed countries are only $16. So if we have a vaccine that costs $100, it really isn't a solution in that particular context. Okay, I'm going to skip through malaria because we're going to come back to malaria next time. I'll just say that malaria is a big problem for children, primarily in tropical areas. In Africa, it's a very, very large problem. And pregnant women are much more susceptible to malaria.
Aren't Africans pretty much immune to malaria?
Malaria is a huge problem in Africa. If we look at the incidence of malaria, African children have between 1 and 5 episodes per year of malaria. So it really is a big health problem. 1 million children under the age of 5 die every year as a result of malaria. Here are the malaria incidence rates. You can see incidence rates are very high in Africa and also in other tropical areas. Let me skip through this. And we'll hear more about this next time. Okay, I also want to take a look at congenital anomalies. 2 to 3% of children are born with a birth defect. And 400,000 children die every year as a result of congenital anomalies. If we look at the fraction of deaths that are due to congenital anomalies, it's a lot higher in developed countries. 17% of deaths in this age group are due to congenital anomalies, whereas only 4% are in developing countries. Why do you think we have that difference? All those other infectious diseases that are less of a problem in developed countries. If we look at the causes of those congenital anomalies, we can basically divide them into three groups: genetic causes, environmental causes, and then complex causes where probably we have an interplay between both environmental exposure and genetic risk factors. In genetic causes, we can have chromosomal deletions or chromosomal rearrangements. Down syndrome would be an example. Or we can have single gene mutations like cystic fibrosis would be an example. Environmental causes, exposure to infectious organisms during pregnancy. For example, if a woman is pregnant and acquires a rubella infection, her child can have very, very severe birth defects as a result of that, which are frequently fatal. That's known as the congenital rubella syndrome, and that's why it's so important to continue to vaccinate against rubella. Maternal nutritional deficiencies, for example, folic acid defects. You may have seen some of the billboards about taking your vitamin B to prevent neural tube defects. And then others where we don't understand all of the genetic and environmental risk factors, for example, congenital heart disease. We can't identify any single environmental cause or genetic cause. It's probably a complex interplay of many factors. Okay, and then finally, I want to finish up with unintentional injuries. We're going to take a look at this a lot more next time. when we talk about causes of death for people aged 15 to 45. But for children, unintentional injuries result in they're the fourth leading cause of death in developed countries, resulting in the death of 15,000 children a year. They're only the ninth leading cause of death in developing countries, but they account for more than 250,000 deaths per year. If we look at the most frequent causes, accidental drowning, we're going to look at the causes of the some of the technologies that can be used to prevent injury and fatality in road traffic injuries next time, because that is a leading cause of death for people aged 15 to 45. So let me stop here. What we've done today is we've taken a look at the contrast between many of the infectious diseases that are a cause of death for children in developing countries. And even in developed countries, we still see that infectious disease, particularly from exposure to organisms in the maternal genital tract, are a cause of death for children in developed countries. Next time, you have one assignment due. That's homework number 2, where you will be calculating some incidence and prevalence rates. And that's it. I'd be happy to take any questions. No? Okay. Yes? I'm sorry? The question was, why do doctors in the United States prefer to give dehydrated children an IV rather than oral rehydration therapy? When oral rehydration therapy was first used, they were trying to fine-tune the mixture of salt and sugar, and some of the formulations that were originally used resulted in patients having elevated sodium levels, and that can cause some neurologic side effects. Now, the formulations which are used today don't cause that at all, but I think it got a bad reputation when it was originally used for that reason. Another thing that contributed to that was there were a few cases where people mixed up the solution incorrectly, and it didn't work as a result. And so it's one of those technologies that had some problems when it was originally used, as a result was never widely adopted, even though there's very, very good evidence that it works and it no longer has those problems. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Oh, I forgot about the t-shirts.